Morning, Paul. It's great to have you with us here today this morning.
Morning, Heidi.
So for everyone out there, my name is Heidi Alaskery, and I have the great honor of being the lead co-chair for Task Force 6, which is the Task Force on Economy, Education, Employment, and the Digital Age. Task Force 6 is one of the 11 task forces of the T20 Engagement Group. For this year under the leadership and hosting of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So it's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to be here with Paul Granger. I will pass it over to Paul to introduce himself.
Hi, Paul Granger. I spent most of my career in what are called technical colleges in the UK, that is training people from the age of 16 upwards to go into some sort of vocational education. But I've been very fortunate in that for the last 15 years, I've been at University College London, where I've been allowed to contemplate the sector which I have spent most of my career working in. And I've been part of similar task forces in the T20 for 3 years, and through the Argentinian presidency and through the Japanese presidency. And now very pleased to be working with the Saudi presidency.
And we have been honored to have you with us, Paul, as well as the rest of our co-chairs who couldn't be with us today, but have certainly significantly contributed to this discussion. As you stated, we are continuing a legacy of work here. I think it shouldn't be seen as discrete pieces of work, but obviously these topics lend themselves to a continuity that's very, very important. Hence having individuals and expertise who have been around and can continue that conversation and make sure we have that continuity is extremely important. The topic of, I always jokingly say that our Task Force 6 has everything but the kitchen sink in terms of the topic that we try to address in a very functional way. They're very relevant. The topics that are addressed impact every aspect of an individual's life. It really takes the continuum from education all the way through employment, which really is a lifelong journey. So the topics that are discussed impact every single individual in the world at every single age group, every single category that you can conceive of, whether it's males, females, you know, migrant workers, individuals with disabilities, advanced countries, developing countries. The topic, I always say, I feel a great weight of responsibility to be as inclusive as we can, to be as responsible as we can in terms of addressing these issues. The issue of the digital age, the Internet of Things, AI, this has been a progressively important topic. And I think, fortunately or unfortunately, we have been given this, what I like to think of as the opportunity of COVID-19. That was certainly a very unexpected twist that we got as the task force very early. I think we were lucky very early on to have COVID come on the scene, because it really allowed us to look at our policy briefs, the issues that we were looking at, and particularly for us looking at the digital age and how AI impacts all of these topical areas, it really allowed us to have a very natural worldwide experiment on how technology impacts those aspects of our lives.
Yes, what was interesting from the education and digital age aspect of COVID is that it accelerated processes that we understood were already happening. In other areas, COVID has actually taken us backwards, environmental issues, for example, and global warming, because the move towards, away from the car and towards public transport has been thrown into reverse. And we had the relatively simple task, I think, in our group, of seeing things which we'd said, well, you know, maybe 5, maybe 10 years, suddenly, We're all dependent upon these remote communication tools, such as we're speaking on now, and haven't they got better in a very short period of time, people have put their head under the bonnet, looked at the technology, and they're much slicker. I mean, you know, in the days of time lapse and what have you, it was very different. So, you know, we had fair warning that we were going to move towards some greater degree of remote activity, and that parallels industrial patterns, because people need less and less to come together in a factory to make a product, because you can data stream and you can have 3D printers and things. So the whole business of how communications take place and how people interact, which we thought would be a 10-20 year sort of period, has taken place in a matter of months. And I think it's been crucial that under Heidi's chair, we have been able to respond to that and come up with some guidelines.
And I think, you know, maybe just to highlight some of the magnitude of this, you know, Paul, you rightly said, you know, it's not that anything really took us by surprise per se. These discussions have been happening. We knew these, you know, issues around the AI, the need for looking at what are the skills of the future, the jobs of the future, what do industries look like moving forward? Those have been the topics of many discussions in many, many circles over, you know, several years, if not decades, gradually working up. What I find interesting and fascinating is, as you stated, the speed. You know, and just to give people context here, you know, within a period of weeks, with, you know, at its height, if we just take the example of education, you know, in April 3rd, 2020, UNESCO has a global monitoring of school closure tracker that you can log online and check. But on April 3rd, 91%, and I'll say that again, 91% of students around the world were out of school overnight.
Yeah,
I think that is unprecedented.
Yeah, I think it's important in terms of moving into employment. I mean, yes, you've got people with a big gap in their knowledge and skills acquisition, which we've got to think about. But in terms of moving into employment, what's changed is not just the things that are visible, like 3D printers or virtual communications, people being YouTube stars and things like that. Those are obvious. What's perhaps less obvious is that the way that people are employed is changing also with the impact of artificial intelligence. So you have the gig worker who looks at their computer every evening to see what they're going to be doing the next day, who markets their services through mobile phones. You've got the platform workers, you've got taxi drivers who are told by a computer where to go, not somebody sitting in an office with a bank of phones, but a computer actually sorting it out. When I get lost in London and I don't know where I am, my phone knows where I am. And these platform that you can access are changing the way that we work. And the skills to survive in that sort of employment are different from the skills that were required to survive in, say, factory employment.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, I think, again, you know, COVID-19 has brought a lot of this to the forefront. And I think we've seen, certainly in terms of how we've developed our policies, how we're looking at it, taking advantage of that discourse and really looking at how can we create a sustainable, healthy infrastructure to ensure that what we're learning as we're going along today, how do we accelerate that, sustain that, and make it most impactful with the least negative impact that can possibly happen. Again, to put this into perspective in terms of employment, and I would love to get your thoughts around this, Paul, because I know you've spent a lot of time looking at these kinds of things. But when we look at just the employment ecosystem in terms of numbers being reported by the ILO or the United Nations, today, with our current circumstance, we have 37.5% of global employment being impacted negatively by the current situation. And most of this negative impact is happening in four main industries: food and accommodation, retail and wholesale, business and service administration, and manufacturing. So while how we look at these, you know, over 2 billion people are being impacted just within those four domains. In addition to those domains, we know that 136 million healthcare and social professionals have been impacted in their work. And certainly, you know, the digitization and AI is a huge impact. It can be a huge leverage and a huge asset across these industries, or it can be our biggest enemy. So your thoughts around those skill sets and those industries and the impact, and, you know, what do you think is going on, and where do you think we're going right now?
Well, I think it's a classic case of the short term and the long term, and of absolute interest to us at the moment is how long is the short term. And Bill Gates has gone public today saying he thinks it'll be over by the end of 2021. Now, most people had hoped it'd be over by Christmas. Now, I haven't had a chance to explore what's the basis of this speculation, but it does look as if there's going to be a first phase of the virus transmitting rapidly around the world, and then when medical technology perhaps masters that, there'll be a longer phase of learning to live with a residual infection of some sort. Now, in the short term, all those jobs which have required human contact are at risk, and that includes teaching. But you know, if your waiter sneezes, it's going to put you off your meal. So people are going to have to move back from those occupations which involve human contact. So we've seen that aviation has been decimated. We've seen that the tourism industry has gone downhill. Mm-hmm. There's always questions about opening pubs, bars, restaurants, and sadly, schools. And so in the short term, the people working in those areas are uncertain of the future. What has become clear, though, are that those areas of social interaction are actually valued. I don't think we realised how much we appreciated it. We're now in the strange situation of children yearning to go to school, which was certainly not the case 20 years ago. So we were probably looking to technology for ways to rebuild the ability to mingle and to socially interact. And we can't at this stage predict what that would be, because the one thing you learn about technology is do not predict it. In the 1990s, the internet took us somewhat by surprise. So it's difficult to anticipate. But there's a longer term issue, which is, I think, dominated by the environmental issue. But that we probably will not fly around the world as much as we did. For the Argentine and Japanese G20s, I was visiting those countries on a regular basis. With Saudi, sadly, I managed to get once and loved it, but sadly, it's been replaced by this sort of mechanism, and it's much more efficient. I was in Dubai twice yesterday, and I was in New York the day before. I'm getting around the world much more quickly and much more environmentally conscious way. And that is going to impact on the nature of work. I've already said, you know, I don't see much future for factories. I think assembly can be managed much more remotely and accurately by machines, and people don't need to be there. On the far side of Argentina, there used to be an aeroplane and motor car manufacturing economy. Well, that's gone completely because it's very expensive to transport heavy, lumpy things from over by the Andes elsewhere. And the economy has moved over to being a digitally based economy, to do with design, creativity, cybersecurity, these new professions. And so part of our agenda that Heidi and I have been discussing is how do you reskill people from building big lumpy things to doing something which is more remote activity? And this brings us firmly back to changing the nature of education, because the knowledge is now being generated not in universities or schools. The knowledge is being generated out there in employment, and particularly with a group of people that I call economic survivors, young people who have learned how to survive in this new world.
Absolutely. And, you know, having said that, I know we've had lots of discussions around this within the T20 in general, just across the board. I think it's the nature of the current situation, and even before this idea of the diversity and inclusion. Obviously, the global focus is youth. We talk a lot about youth. We talk a lot about women. And I was very excited to see that, you know, G20 in general, that, you know, a lot of the focus is on diversity and inclusion, opportunities for all. And working in this space, and particularly my background is within disability, you know, when we have this discussion, I think AI in this digital age is an absolutely amazing opportunity for people to have this ease. When you say I was able to basically beam into, you know, Dubai twice yesterday and come back, you know, that's surreal. Years ago, we saw that on TV. We never thought that this would be a reality where we could, you know, for me, I think one of the more interesting experiences I've had in terms of just trying to get my work done is being beamed into working group rooms and then just being pulled out.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, Heidi, and there are two issues, really. Youth, of course, young people are adapting to this new world much more quickly than the older workers. But if we're to return to a dynamic economy, we can't rely on young people doing all the jobs. We have to find employment for those who are having to, somewhat reluctantly, move from traditional forms of employment into less traditional forms of employment. So I was working in Wales, where a steelworks was downsizing rapidly. And we were working with people in their 30s and 40s who had had profitable jobs as engineers in the steelworks and didn't know what their future was. And fortunately, we stumbled across cybersecurity, and there's now a thriving cybersecurity industry happening in Wales, making use of those engineering skills, but they've transferred them into something which is more marketable. So reskilling of adults, I think, is going to be very important. And if in our recommendations we say, if nations don't invest in that, then it'll be to their detriment, because they'll have a lot of people who are economically inactive, and that has both financial and social costs.
Absolutely. And I know a lot of the discussions, you know, we've been involved in as a task force, I've personally been involved in myself, is also this idea of inclusion and accessibility to the technology. So it's not only just having the skill set, but the very fundamental principle that everybody should have the equal opportunity and equal access to get that opportunity to be part of these platforms. You know, again, I think technology can be a great unifier. It can provide great opportunities, or it can be an area where it just completely widens the gaps. And those who were left behind become even further left behind simply because they don't have an internet connection, a strong enough connection. They don't have the skills to be able to get onto platforms. Platforms are not accessible and don't address in the appropriate language, the appropriate manner to which various stakeholder groups would need it to be for them to impactfully and effectively be able to engage and take advantage of these opportunities.
Exactly so. And this is where the G20 can come in decisively. We've always been beset by education being undermined by people wanting to make a quick buck. And I think there's a really important role for the G20 to set standards. Standards of access to the internet, standards of students being able to have laptops or some machine to get access in a virtual way. But also standards in terms of qualifications. Too many students follow qualifications which don't actually lead to gainful employment. And I think there needs to be some sort of consensus around the world at what point you move on from those studies which are part of your civic rights, such as history or literature, but then move into something which trains you for gainful employment and not for the employment of the past. So one of the difficulties of apprenticeships is that it can be backward looking. This is how we've done things for the last 20 years and we're going to teach you. We've got to make sure that vocational institutions are forward looking and interact with industry. The other important point you touched on there is that people don't learn passively. I mean, you get some real keen so-and-sos who will download MOOCs from California and teach themselves how to do something very, very complex. But most people don't. Learning hurts. And really, you need social encouragement to learn and fear. I mean, I've learned an awful lot about how to get myself into Zoom over the last few weeks because it's the only way I've remained economically active. But you have now such sophisticated, immersive technologies. My grandson plays a game called Fortnite, and his friends join him in the same football pitch or wherever they are, and he has a conversation with his friends in some sort of exotic tropical island. It's immersive, it's total. I sometimes worry that it's taking over his life. But if you've got that sort of technology in the games industry, that's wonderful for education because it's social and it sort of takes over your world and it allows for interactions. And the only thing which undermines it at the moment is time zones. So that we three had an interesting conversation yesterday about when to have this meeting. Exactly. And Saudi is relatively easy, but Japan and the UK are 9 hours apart. Oh, but apart from that, the ability to have synchronistic interactions brings the teacher back into the situation. And that's really important, that you're being taught by a person and not by a machine.
And I think that, you know, that touches on a really important aspect, and I like to look at it from a different perspective. I was having a discussion with a close friend of mine the other day who's in the US, but she was very concerned that her young child, who's in kindergarten, would not be going back to school, that they would be doing distant learning, and the impact that would have on their social, pragmatic, sort of interactive, developing social skills. And she was so concerned that she actually seeked out the services of a counselor and psychologist to get some advice. And, you know, it's a really difficult situation, I think, for parents, and people don't realize at just a very fundamental human, you know, personal one-to-one level, how distressing this is for families. And the psychologist had told the mom, she said, yes, it may be distressing for your child to sit at home today, but it may be healthier in that they can have healthy interactions, non-restricted in a sense that I can see you, I see your whole face, we can talk, we can be online for a long period of time. However, if they go to school, they're forced into this very unnatural situation of having their masks on, not being allowed to touch and interact with other children. And a simple act of, you have a kindergartner who's separating from their parent and starts crying. The teacher is not allowed to hold and hug that child and comfort them because of social distancing. So just to think how much these changes are changing our behaviors and the skill set that teachers have gained over the years, how to be compassionate, how to be empathetic, all of those soft skills that some of us naturally employ or we learn through experience on the job. And we have to rethink those things that were somewhat subconscious and really think about these soft skills in a very conscious way.
And you know, there is a short-term crisis. And you mentioned right at the beginning of this conversation, You mentioned that COVID was an opportunity. And mm-hmm. one way of looking at that is that we have learned to value social interactions and being yes. together. So that, as it were, redoubles humankind's dedication to finding a way round the virus to restore the things that we like the cuddle in the playground, which is so important. And in the long term, I think it indicates to us that we are not going to live in a world which is dominated by machines, that we must remain masters. We design what they do, we make use of what they do, but I think there's going to be a recalibration of social values. Mm-hmm. So I think health is going to be much higher up the agenda than it has mm-hmm. been internationally. The caring professions have been woefully underpaid, and look how important they've been—the thin blue line, protecting us from COVID. So I think they will be valued much more. Hopefully, machines will make their lives easier, and machines can do the menial tasks, the cleaning and so forth, which is the less pleasant side, but the. Intellectual side of caring and health, I think, will become much more important. And as people need less work or less time working because it becomes so much more efficient, then look how much we value things like the theatre. Don't we miss the theatre, the cinema? Don't we miss our Absolutely. Sporting events? So I think one of the slogans of the G20 is Build Back Better. And I think we've got a better I think we have an improved understanding of what that better is going to be.
Yeah. And I think, you touched on it beautifully, when we talk about this healthier, a health build back better and healthier, I agree with you. I think this period that we're going through really has also highlighted the importance of mental wellness. Yes, we talk about the social engagement, and interaction and the impact technology has on either increasing, decreasing, improving it, but also the potential negative effects in terms of mental wellness and resilience. Resilience in terms of, the upcoming workforce and what we need to be able, to process and learn and withstand moving forward. We have to have resilience. We have to have wellness. And what we've seen with all of this is our mental wellness could be at risk. And there has to be a concerted effort. What is the impact of technology on mental wellness? What is the impact of parents having to learn to teach their children at home? The reason I sent my kids to really good schools and I handpicked them was I wanted them to learn the skills that they needed to have a sustainable, rich future where they could find viable, quality jobs and vocations that would give them the quality of that life that I want for them. And I realized that I wasn't the teacher that was able to give that to them. But yet, and I'm fortunate that my children are older today, but for individuals who have very young children, they are now being asked to be teachers overnight. That's a whole new skill set. And I know you and I talk about this a lot. We are fortunate to have many years and a lot of experience under our belt. But with the globe focusing on youth and the skills and the opportunities needed for youth moving forward and the world we need to build for them, I think there is a very important discussion to be had that, yes, we have a large population that's youthful, but we also have quite a large population of 30 and above and 60 and above. And when we're talking about these shifts today, what are the skill sets needed? We live in a reality that we're living longer as humans today.
Yeah, well, let's hope so.
A 60-year-old, 70-year-old today is no longer necessarily enjoying retirement in the golden years. 60 and 70-year-olds are actually still looking at re-entering the workforce because they absolutely have to for economic reasons.
We can generalize to some extent yeah. that the jobs which are being taken away by AI, whether it's COVID or not, the fourth industrial revolution, the jobs that are being taken away are low order jobs. I don't want to be rude about anybody, but at one time, so I won't, you know, say who's unnecessary, but the low order jobs. At one time, when you bought petrol, someone would come out of the garage and put the pump into your car and would serve you the petrol. Now we do it for ourselves, and somebody in a sort of central and protected office can sell much more petrol. And so those low order jobs are disappearing. So when we look at reskilling, it's not just taking one set of skills, running a roller in a steel mill, and to another set of skills, which is cybersecurity. What you've done is you've ratcheted up the complexity of the employment. So it is very important for us in education, whether directly or as parents, whatever, to understand that people have got to have much more in the way of cerebral skills if yes. they're going to do the jobs that control the machines. The machine takes away the drudgery, that's great. And I applaud that. I haven't just lost my job as a waiter in a restaurant, so you know I'm in a position to be able to applaud it. But basically, those things are changing. And in Japan, for example, where it's an aging population, the average age is 45, there are concerns about care for the elderly. And right. so a lot of work is going on in Japan about how care can be automated in some ways. And then
as far as I know they've developed robots to be there to socialize with the elderly and make
that frees up the carers to do the more yeah. cerebral activity of entertaining these people, giving them a sense of purpose, making their old age stimulating. So we're moving all the time to people having to be able to communicate, able to design, able to create, able even to entertain. And that takes a lot of careful interaction. So Michael Young, who's written quite a lot on this, brought out a piece about 3 or 4 years ago now, where he says, we no longer need to think about training people to stand at a lathe and produce goods. We've got to think about people perhaps engaging in literature, because that teaches you about social interactions, reading the other person, telling the narrative around what's going. That's the sort of human interaction that we need. And one of the difficulties with AI is people assuming that it can replace human activities such as judgment. So we've just had a mishap in the UK.
I was just going to bring that up, yes.
An algorithm.
It's only as good as what we put into it.
That's right. An algorithm was used to identify what grade a student was going to get. And these algorithms were inadequate and produced a great deal of injustice. And a lot of people got grades which they violently disagreed with. Because awarding a grade, a qualification, at the end of a period of learning is a complex act of judgment. And that judgment needs to be tested against the judgment of others, so that you come to some sort of common award. What you can't have is awards being easier to get in Scotland than they are in Wales. That would be a stupidity. So it's a very complex, interactive, human activity. And in the end, it comes down to making a judgment based upon your experience and your own knowledge and what have you. Now, when machines start being able to do that, I'm going to pack up and die a problem. It just won't happen.
I completely agree. And certainly in the space of human resource management, we see a lot of talk around the AI about being able to produce recruitment processes, interview processes that are a lot less biased. But again, those systems are only as good as what we put into them. It's only as good as how we program those systems. Are we making sure that we're not putting unintended biases, because the programmer is not being inclusive of everybody. It's not teaching the system in the way we're allowing the systems to learn. Their deep learning and develop is based on the rules and the parameters that we put into it. And I think, you know, this again opens up a lot of, you know, when you say replacing employment opportunities. Just that idea of how do we teach, you know, software engineers, this whole space of how do you develop these systems is the new and upcoming new world of potential opportunities and viable vocation. But it's really going to take individuals who have life experience, who have been exposed socially extremely well, so that they bring that life experience and try and recreate it and embed it in these systems so that these systems are just and fair and unbiased in terms of how they operate.
Part of what drives artificial intelligence is data. And we've seen a lot of things develop recently to do with mass data gathering.
Yes.
But two things about data gathering. One is that it has to be retrospective. Where you gather data, it's about what's been done already. So when you talk about the sort of programs like the HR programs that are sometimes used, some poor lady was on television this morning, she'd had to go through 1,000 applications for a job because we're approaching 15% unemployment in the UK.
Yeah.
And obviously it's tempting to use a machine to go through the 1,000 applications. And you can put in the data of previous appointments and what was looked for. But what they found was that actually made prejudice permanent. You know, so people from low postcodes and from poor postcodes didn't get jobs. Okay. Computer says, right, this comes from a poor postcode, we'll get rid of this one, or a certain racial characteristic, or so forth. It actually cements prejudice into the system. So we have to use our judgment to say, no, that's no good. Data can't be creative.
Absolutely. And I know a lot of the discussions we've had and a lot of the policies that we've worked on in our task force, particularly some of them that I can think of very, very vividly, really look at this idea of bias and how we're managing the data, not just the bias and how we put it in and how it can be skewed and how it can widen the gaps or cement and really, embed discrimination, but also safety and security around it. You know, as you just rightly said, if I put my data in one system, it resides there for eternity. And does that get flagged every single time somebody searches me? Somebody was telling me the other day that they were shocked that something that existed even 20 years ago somehow got on the internet about them. And now it's one of the most salient things that comes up when you search them. And they don't even know where it came from, how to get rid of it, how to manage it. So just really managing your own information online and the safety and security and your autonomy, what you want to share, what are the boundaries around that, and then really getting into safety and security. You know, it's one thing to have your information out there, but it's a whole nother thing if it's being used in a way that is harmful to you.
And one of the interesting things I've done this year has been to work with colleagues on T6, a different task force, T11, on cybersecurity. If people are not given, we've talked so far about skills for employment, but we've touched around the edges on skills for living. And one of the skills for living that people need to know is how to protect themselves from unsuitable data collection. I mean, while we're talking, our phones are listening to us, and certain key words will be being mined out of it. And the next thing you'll know, on Facebook, there's an advert for something that we've been discussing. We have to learn to guard against the abuse of that. One of the things I do is I lie about my date of birth on Facebook. I make myself a lot older, because date of birth is a tool for people beginning to invade your privacy. As a result of being a great deal older, I get adverts about the things that take you up downstairs automatically. I've lost the phrase.
Yes.
I get
the accessible lifts and the chairs. Yeah.
Offered lots of useful services like funerals and so forth. So.
Oh my God.
We live in a world where we've got to be data savvy, and in teaching the skills for living, knowing how to be secure in terms of your finances, in terms of information that you do not want to appear in the social media, is a skill we're going to have to develop. And that's, again, comes back to the cerebral side of life, that we're going to need not just for working, but also for living. We are going to have to continue to improve our intelligence to be able to thrive in this data-rich world.
Absolutely. And, you know, I know, again, working on Task Force 6 with our colleagues, we've certainly looked at many of these topics that we've discussed, and whether it's on our specific task force or, you know, many of these topics cross against other engagement groups. As you stated, you know, we've worked with the artificial intelligence, we've worked with the education groups, we've worked with the B20, the Business 20, the Labor 20. You know, these topics certainly are not isolated just to one task force on the T20. And I think what has become very apparent, one of the strengths in working and the strength of the G20 addressing these issues is the ability to bring together such a large number of stakeholders across various countries, various think tanks. I mean, just within our task force, we have over 200 members, you know, across, you know, many, many countries thinking about these same topics from various aspects so that we get this very comprehensive look where we can try to be as inclusive as possible, to be able to really look at all the nuances of a topic and make sure that we're addressing it in a way that is that serves the global community and not just isolated communities. We talk about the risk of this as well. What happens if we don't listen to all of these individuals and take...
And it's an interesting process, isn't it? Because we've had a fascinating year where we've thought about these issues. And then we have to draw out the main strands for the politicians who are going to meet in November. And of course, politicians tend to be soundbite orientated and have limited timescales in which to look at these things. So we've got to make the messages broad and simple. And I think we're getting there in the policy briefs. The G20 is about where there is a need for global action. And there is a need for global action in terms of ensuring that everyone has access to the new media. And to, you know, it is reprehensible that there are parts of the world which do not have access to the internet. And we need to make sure that it doesn't become a platform for criminals. So we need to look very much at cybersecurity. And we need to have international agreements on things like the handling of data. Is it acceptable that Alexa listens to all your private conversations? We need to have international agreement that one can't avoid a law limiting your activity by moving to a different jurisdiction. And they did that with the banking when G20 started a dozen years ago. They came up with international protocols on how banks should be managed. And I think with skills, education skills, jobs, skills for life, we need to have global agreements on basic minimums, basic standards, and something around that very difficult concept, justice.
Absolutely. Justice, inclusion, making sure that we leave no one behind, and making sure that we're empowering everyone to have a decent quality of life across the lifespan with various checkpoints as we age to ensure that nobody falls through the cracks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paul, it is always a pleasure to speak with you and discuss things and, you know, I look forward to moving these discussions forward, to bringing this to life, not only for the G20 and our politicians, but this truly is a discussion that impacts every single person living on the face of this earth today.
Can I go on record, Heidi, and thanking you for the way that you've chaired this task force this year, because it has been absolutely stimulating, but also purposeful. Because I think we've come up with some practical solutions. We haven't just had an arcane conversation, which would have been very pleasant, but we've come up with some very, very strong principles at a time of global crisis. And your firm leadership, your skillful chairing of our meetings has been a joy to watch. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been an honor, and I've been extremely humbled It's very rare that you can have these kinds of discussions that are very human and very heartfelt, but also very embedded in science and research and looking at real data. And to have the privilege of working with so many great minds, with so much experience and so much passion and dedication to what you do and what the rest of our task force does and the individuals there, has been a true pleasure. So we really look forward to seeing the outcomes of this. We look forward to looking at what happens beyond the chairmanship of Saudi Arabia. We know it'll be handed over. We realize that these conversations don't end. And that's extremely important, setting the platform that the network stays alive, that we stay in contact, that we continue to work on these issues as they develop. So having individuals like yourself and Peter and Alejandra and all of the rest of our task force that have been part of this discussion for years now is extremely critical for us in terms of moving forward. So that is a priority that we will look to make sure that there's sustainability, that makes sure that these discussions stay rich, stay relevant, stay current to what's going on the ground, and adapt to the needs of each individual that we have the responsibility of representing.
Let's hope that the next round of T20 moves us from the short term to the long term, and that we can reconcile COVID to history.
Inshallah, God willing. God bless everyone, and we hope everybody stays safe and well. And we look forward to seeing a very exciting and prosperous future.